Okay, this is a 30-second commercial, and I'm going to throw a lot of numbers at you, but please stay with me. In just 15 minutes, you could save 15% or more on car insurance. This company has been offering great rates and great service for over 75 years, and anytime you need help, you can speak to one of their trained specialists 24/7. That company is GEICO. Go to geico.com today. Sorry for all the numbers, and in 5, 4, 3, 2, 1, I'm out of time.
Now, Podcast One brings you Spike's Car Radio. A downloadable Cars and Coffee, hosted by writer, comedian, and automotive enthusiast, Spike Ferriston. Now, here's Spike.
Hi, everybody. Welcome to Spike's Car Radio. Got a treat for you today. You probably don't know this about our little podcast. We have a booking department. Booking department here at Podcast One that works very hard. They send me a lot of pitches every week. At least, I don't know, what do you think, Will? Like 5 or 6 pitches a week? And I would say that I probably reject 5 or 6 pitches a week. But last week they sent me one of my former Seinfeld colleagues, Larry Charles. And I instantly said yes. I'll tell you why. He's got a new project at Netflix, but also because Larry and I both wrote for Seinfeld, but we both wrote at very different times. Larry, as you know, that I like to use this word seminal. He's one of the seminal Seinfeld writers, and I'm one of the closers. I came in and closed it down. But really, Larry was there on the front lines in the beginning. You may also know him as the director of the Borat movies. I think Bruno, too. You did all of those, mm-hmm. right?
Yeah.
There's so much I want to talk to you about, Larry. And right. I feel like as far as Seinfeld writers, I probably know the least about you of any than any of the other writers, I think. Right?
Happy to share.
All right. Well, let's start. You know, I want to get into the new project, and we'll get into that because it's cool.
By the way, let me just – if I could digress.
Sure.
When you said you're one of the closers, it reminded me, like, when I was a kid, you know, when Sanford and Son and those kind of shows were kind of reaching the end of their
yes.
runs, they had these two producers. They were very well known at the time, and they were known as the Undertakers. And they would come in and kind of wrap the show up, make it look pretty for that last season.
Right. So. It didn't feel like Seinfeld ever got to that point, right?
It never did. That's amazing.
We were maybe there. I know on the inside we felt like we were like the last 2 years we were kind of like, all right, we feel like it's wrapping up. But the audience hasn't figured it out yet.
That's
and then
right.
Jerry called it. Well, here's my first question.
Yes.
Are you a Larry a guy or a Jerry guy? Larry David guy or a Jerry Seinfeld guy?
Larry.
You know what I'm talking about?
Yeah.
You're
well,
a Larry guy.
Larry was on Fridays. That was my first job. And that's where I met him. And he took me under his wing. And so that's my Larry connection.
Ah, okay.
He's been like I often say he's been maybe the most important person in my adult life. I met him when I was 22. You know, he's the one that's really
Where do you meet Larry David?
At Fridays. He was cast on Fridays. I used to sell jokes in front of the Comedy Store. Before there were computers, I would handwrite jokes on a legal pad
really?
And sell those jokes. And one of those comedians got a job on the TV show Fridays.
Yeah.
And that's where Larry was. And I met him, and we immediately gravitated from the same neighborhood, that golden triangle of Jewish comedy,
yep.
Brighton Beach, the Jamaica of comedy, really, in some ways.
And Larry was a writer on the show?
And a performer.
So he was
very
a writer
versatile,
performer.
Very versatile performer. He put a wig on, he'd be Han Solo. It was amazing, actually. He did Nixon. I mean, he was great.
I've always been fascinated by Fridays. Now, was that ABC that
yes.
was trying to do Saturday Night Live? And their big
yes.
idea was, we'll do it on Friday.
Yes. So,
right? That
yes.
was the big idea.
Very original.
How did that show – you know, we know that like Saturday Night Live is writers start to congregate and then pitch Monday, Tuesday and work the sketches and then go live on Saturday night. Fridays, well, how did that work? Was it a live show?
It was a live show.
Okay.
On Mondays, the person would deliver the cocaine.
Right.
And then
I used to intern from him on Saturday Night Live, by the way.
The sketches would be written. Oh, you know, there was a lot of competition, as there probably was on Saturday Night
right.
Live also. You wanted to get sketches on. You wanted to get sketches on the first hour because that last half hour was like kind of a death knell
right.
for the sketches. So there was a lot of competition for the opening sketch and for the guest star sketches. And so it was a good, healthy competition. It kind of forced your writing to reach a different level.
Who is your competition? It's just Johnny Carson, right? That's the only guy in Late Night in that moment.
There was nothing really. It was very open, actually. A Nightline hadn't come on yet. Even.
Right.
So those kind of shows hadn't even developed yet. And only Johnny Carson was the only competition really
right.
at that point.
Wow.
And we actually at some point – and Saturday Night Live itself was really in a kind of a low ebb, mm-hmm. as I recall at that time too. So it was really ripe for a show like this. And
right.
it worked out okay for
every
a couple
season
years.
Every season of Saturday Night Live feels like a low ebb when you're part of it. And then you look back at it and you go, oh my God, that was the golden season.
Well, and Larry and I both have very different experiences of Fridays because
right.
he was already a veteran comedian and he just didn't truck any nonsense.
Right.
I was 22. I'd been a bellhop. That was my last job. And so I was just I'm in show business, man.
You're
I was thrilled.
Funny.
Yeah, I loved it. You know, I had a great time.
Did
I met the Clash and I got to hang out with these rock stars.
I know. It's great. It yeah. really is a great thing to be a part of, those sketch shows when you're young and you're in New York. I remember every moment of SNL. I
yeah.
loved it. Who else was – was Julia on that show too?
No.
She wasn't. So
no.
she was SNL cast
yes,
later on, right?
Yes,
okay.
yes.
I guess I don't remember that moment. So
Michael Richards was on that.
Yes. Right. Oh, my God.
Michael
what
Richards
a crew.
Was on
so
that
wait,
show.
What was Larry like pitching in the room? Was he as volatile as he is on stage or was as a stand-up where he would yell at the audience after if they didn't get a joke?
Well, you can imagine that's exactly how we bonded because we go into those big pitch meetings
yes.
and we would wind up both be the people that had the biggest fights with the producers always about what we should be doing and we can't compromise
right.
and we can have these crazy – so he was much more intense about it at that time. I think over the years and success – and time have kind of tempered that a little bit.
Okay, let's flash forward to Seinfeld
yes.
then. Because I've heard stories, and I don't know if any of this is true or not, but I've heard – I remember being on the show and hearing about the early days of Seinfeld and hearing that things didn't really start working right until Larry Charles got here. Now, I know you might want to answer that in a very humble way and have some humility, but don't. Was it – you know, because Larry and Jerry had never really run a show before and, you know, maybe they were a little in over their heads. I don't. Fill me in on a little of that history there.
Well, that's very flattering. Thank you, first of all. Secondly
– I just said it was a rumor.
Yes, exactly, and I'm going to put it to rest now. But this building actually is where Castle Rock
right.
was
yeah,
housed.
That's right.
So we
that's
used to
right.
first meet in this building. So I spent a lot of time here, actually.
Yeah.
Initially, you know, I'm sure you've seen.
So wait, you were here talking about the show before it was on the air.
Absolutely,
with Larry and
for
Jerry.
A long time, right?
And who else was part of that creative team?
At first, I never
was
saw
Rob Reiner. I heard was around
they were,
at that
all
point.
The Castle Rock guys hovered around,
right.
but they really didn't get too involved with what we were doing at
right.
that time. It wasn't until later that they really were kind of inserting themselves.
Glenn Padnick is the greatest.
And Alan. What was his name? Adam Scheinman.
Yep.
They were probably the two most outside people who were involved.
And
you know?
And Steve Bannon showed up to a lot of meetings.
Steve Bannon was always there, always pitching.
Were you like me surprised when you read Steve Bannon and Seinfeld in the same new one?
I was.
I don't know what do you mean. How is he involved in this
yes,
show?
Yes, exactly. He's profiting. he's actually making more money than
yeah.
anybody.
It made no sense, right?
Yeah.
And now people think he was part of that initial team, but
yes.
he wasn't. So
maybe
you were in at the very beginning, and Larry brought you in there. Right?
Yes, he did. At first, he tried to bring me in when it was still just before the pilot, and he had never done a sitcom and I had never done a sitcom
wow.
and so they would not allow him to hire me
mm-hmm.
then after those first four episodes, which you know was a whole saga in itself, he was finally able to take control of the show, and at that time he was able to hire me. So he really made
wow.
me a sitcom writer, and later on with Curb, it was the same thing. He made me a director, so he really changed the course
right,
of my life.
Right,
very, very specifically.
Well, he, yeah, you know, when you say that, Larry made you a writer. I remember, you know, him just saying, "I don't want you to come up with stories. I want you to come in and tell stories." And what a relief that was to hear, because
yeah.
I was in over my head at that point too. I'd been a joke writer for Letterman for 5 years,
yeah,
and I get hired on this number one sitcom that, frankly, I hadn't watched a lot because I was always working. And was terrified most of the time until Larry said, just come in and tell more of these soup Nazi stories.
Right, right.
You know, it's like, really?
And it is,
you're going to make episodes out of that?
And it is terrifying, too.
Yeah,
and,
yeah.
And that was a great thing about Larry, too. He was as terrified as I was.
Yeah,
everybody
yeah.
was terrified. We didn't know what we were doing.
Right.
You know, and yet at the same time, we had a very fatalistic attitude. The show will go on for 13 episodes. It'll get canceled. So let's just do whatever we
it
want.
Almost did.
We'll be free, you know.
Right.
And that really was, that abandon really sort of set the tone for the show.
Yeah, and he really felt it. I remember at the end of the seasons that we had one season of overlap, I think, and he was always so relieved that they managed to make 22 episodes. It was just like, finally we did it, because he cared so much about the comedy, as did Jerry. But at the end of it, he was almost disappointed the show would get picked up.
Absolutely. He was very disappointed. Well, you know the story about Wednesday nights. We were originally on Wednesday nights at 9:30, losing to Jake and the Fat Man.
Right.
And NBC and Castle Rock come to him and say to him, "We're going to put you on Thursday after Cheers."
Oh, my God.
And everybody's beaming. And he's like, "Anybody who doesn't watch us on Wednesday can go fuck themselves."
Right.
That's what he actually said.
Right.
He said to Warren Littlefield's face.
Yes.
I was standing there. So they said, "No, Larry, come on." And they talked him into going on Thursday nights. So he was always resistant.
Right.
One year they had the Olympics. So they came to him. Warren said, "Could you do two extra episodes this year to tie in with the Olympics?" He's like, "You got to be kidding me." But I wound up writing those episodes because we wound up doing them. And I had like
– What were the episodes? Do you remember?
The trip. The keys
leading
into the trip.
The trip part one and the trip part two.
Exactly. And I had the most autonomy I probably ever had on the show because he really didn't want anything to do with it. So it worked out. It worked out very well, actually.
Weren't you confused? Because this was the first time I was seeing network executives ever. Right? I just, as the receptionist of Saturday Night Live, I never met them.
Yes.
As a writer on Letterman, I was always shielded from them. So I came into this situation where we'd be having lunch and Jerry would parade, and Larry would parade the network executives in, and they would do these pitches like you're saying.
Yes.
"We'd like to have a crossover with a single guy."
Yes.
And he'd go, "Come around, writers. Writers, the network would like to pitch. The network would like to pitch." And then he would basically humiliate these guys right in front of us. They would blush and go, "I had to come. I had to pitch it. I know you're not going to do it, but at least it's done." I remember Warren Littlefield came and was serving us eggs. You know, he's like, "We're having," that's what the president of the network does. So, you know, a lot of us had trouble leaving that show and going off into the real world.
Yes.
And were perceived as very, very arrogant, but we were just doing what we were taught.
We were all in our way like our own bubble boys. We were bubble boys.
We
really
didn't know. Yeah. I just thought that's the way you talk to executives. You didn't really, you weren't out to humiliate them, but you were there to defend the creative on your show, and they were relegated off to the side. Boy, that was not true. That was not true at all.
Well, I remember them coming to him. I remember Warren coming to him about, you were saying, crossover episodes and tying things together. There was a blackout night.
Yeah, right.
And they went to him, and it's like, they knew halfway through pitching him the blackout episode that it wasn't going to work. They just stopped and walked out. They gave up before they even finished.
So the baby shower.
Yes.
The statue, the heart attack, the fix-up, the keys, the trip, part one and part two, the airport, the old man, the bris, the stall, the fire. Those are your episodes.
Yeah, yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's about 10 episodes?
I think there's 18 altogether.
Wow.
Yeah,
all right.
18 or so.
So you were on from season one to season five?
Well, see, I get confused. Like, I don't know what season – at the time, I never
were six episodes, right?
Yeah, you had like 4 and then 13 and then the 22. And so I worked on about 80 episodes. That's how I kind of
– And why did you leave the show?
I reached the point in the last season that I was there, you know, the pressure of trying to come up with the stories. And I started to feel that I was not feeling fresh about it.
Right.
And not feeling like I was breaking through and not coming up with ideas that were exciting me. And I was getting kind of – I was reaching the wall.
Uh-huh.
And I'm the kind of person – I'm not a career-oriented person. So I wasn't thinking, well, this is something – I should just stick with this for the rest of my life.
Right.
Which I could have done, I'm sure. They were happy. We were all happy. But they knew I was also a hungry person and a kind of restless person. And I felt at that point creatively I needed to do something else. And I decided to move on.
And you told them?
I said, I think I have to go. And
that
must
have been upsetting to those guys.
They were very supportive, though, always. Larry, again,
they
and Jerry.
They say that.
Yeah.
But I know what it's like to let writers go that are great and are performing for you, get what you're doing, you know.
Yeah.
They're what help you sleep at night. A guy like you is helping Larry and Jerry sleep at night.
Well, I'm happy to do that. But we were
and then
lucky.
And you disappear, and then you're like, what are we going to do this season,
but
right?
But you and Dave and all those guys, Alec and Jeff and all those guys, showed up and really like came in and it's like the Giants won a Super Bowl with one team, but they created another team to win a Super Bowl, and that's what you guys did also.
I don't know. I really felt it when Larry left, though. I mean, I enjoyed, and I'm a Jerry guy. I've always been a Jerry guy. I love Larry and I love Larry's writing, but he and I never really got friendly. But I'm such a fan of his, and I was so – I just wanted two more years, two more seasons with him to just learn to do what he's doing.
Yeah.
Because he was so good at these simple little writing tips that had nothing to do with it. You know, just stuff I had never heard before.
Well, he has an incredible instinct, which I don't know. On stage, I guess in his early days, it was very raw and
right.
not refined yet. But as far as the show went, he had such a sharp and well-honed instinct about tone so he could do the masturbation episode, the contest, and not have any notes.
Right.
I mean, that was something very, very hard. That needle, that thread was very hard to needle, or needle was hard to thread. Whatever the – it was difficult for him.
Right.
And he did it over and over
did
and over again.
Did you ever have the experience, like in a scene where you go – where he would go, no, that's too funny. You know what?
Yes.
We've got too many laughs in this scene. Let's pull two or three out.
Yes. And I'm also still... it would dominate and you would lose track of really what the – there's
right.
a bigger laugh to be had sometimes.
Yeah.
You didn't want to get distracted by an early laugh and lose your way to the bigger laugh
that was
down the road.
That was the thing he left before I could understand it. I'm still not quite sure because I've never heard someone say it's too funny. Let's pull some out. But then you watch the episode and you see what he means. But I always wanted to know, how did he see that so quickly before we got to the edit room.
I think he is somebody, unlike most people, unlike me, who's very self-conscious.
Right.
He's somebody who has complete trust of his instincts. He doesn't really second guess himself when it comes to his creative choices.
So after Seinfeld, you take a little vacation. Then where do you end up? Matt? Is it Mad About You?
I went to Mad About You. I thought, you know, I was in the middle of a marriage, very difficult. And
I can write these stories, but about marriage.
Yeah.
I thought,
you know, I don't, you know, Seinfeld was never about any kind of emotion. It was just, it was avoided at all costs like a bad allergy. And here was a show that was all about emotion.
Right.
So I thought, well, that could be a challenge. Really working with the actors and being the showrunner was an interesting challenge to me. And I had this thing in the back of my mind of directing, but I kind of saw that fading away as I kept on moving in these sitcoms and show running for these sitcoms. So I did that for a couple of seasons.
And you've also got Reiser, who's a smart, funny stand-up who
Absolutely.
Knows to write.
Yes,
so that
yes.
is also
And also trying to make it
for,
making it excellent. That was a very hard show to write. Great writers on the show. Jinji Cohan was on that show. Great, great writers, but it was a writer's room.
Right.
And unlike Seinfeld, we never had a writer's room when I was at Seinfeld.
Yeah.
And you kind of wrote your own thing.
How did it work then when you say that? Was it just still Larry and Jerry? You turn in the script to them, they would work it out and call you in occasionally to fix problems.
Exactly.
Yeah.
That was it.
Great system.
That was it.
Great system.
And
it
worked great.
Allowed me to take vacations, go skiing in Vail. I remember getting a call going,
I never went anywhere.
Larry and Jerry are looking for you. I go, I'm in Vail skiing. With who? The rest of the writing staff. What are you doing there? We're doing your script this week. Oh, well, someone should have told me that. But can't you guys handle it?
No, I never left the office. I was we lived there at that time. Very, very much so.
No, we were there an awful lot. That was just one weekend. We were stealing two days to just get away. But we were there. I don't know if it was like this for you, but in the summertime, we had Saturdays and sometimes off and Sundays definitely. And then when we crossed into January, it was 7 days a week.
Yeah,
and
because you had also scripts that didn't work out that had to be worked on the weekend. The schedule may have changed by the time you got there also, but the weekend was like work days really for us because the show was taped like on a Tuesday or a Wednesday. I can't remember anymore, but it wasn't taped on a Friday night.
Right, right.
So that kind of switched our week. Also, our writing week was really thrown off. But he was known, Larry was known privately, secretly by the staff, not the writers, but by the rest of the staff as Scrooge because he would want to work on Christmas Eve. We were going to finish that script before we left, you know, and, you know, the rest of the crew was waiting to go home.
And he had that, where did he stay? At the Sportsman's Lodge?
Sportsman's Lodge.
Did he stay there when you were?
Yeah, he lived.
So that's right from the very beginning, right?
Well, he had a house on Vantage somewhere, actually. He had a couple of houses for a while there. And then he got married to Laurie.
Yeah.
You know, so his life started to change a lot at that time.
But to give context to the listeners, we're talking about the show shoots in Studio City and the other end of LA, West LA, is where the houses are and you raise a family. There started to be many nights where Larry would stay in the hotel.
Yeah.
And he just liked it. But, you know, I can understand that because we were having so much fun on this show. It was really fun to be there. Everybody was so kind. And, you know, Gamble and Pross are the guys who brought me in.
Yeah,
they were there to kind of help me figure it out.
They're They're the bridge people, really, because they're there the last season I'm there, and they kind of bridged to
your crew. They got me on to Letterman. They got me into The Simpsons. Yeah. They were, you know, it was a time where there weren't a lot of comedy writers out there trying to do this.
They're great guys. They're great guys.
Now it's a mess.
Well, I don't know what is it. I don't know what it is, really.
I don't know.
I'm not sure what it is.
So. I don't know. Well, your new comedy on Netflix is the first thing I've seen that I've wanted to watch in a long time.
Thank you. Right? Thank you.
I had no idea that you were going down this road, but when I saw it, it made sense to me. I think somewhere here I found a trailer for it.
Yeah.
I could even play here. Let me see. I've got the Rolling Stone thing. Oh, here we go. This is Larry Charles, Dangerous World of Comedy.
Filled with hate and violence and war, and amazingly enough, comedy.
When you are not funny, you are what in English?
You are not funny.
Borat, Bruno, and Religulous. All three of my faves.
People forget they live in a war zone. Into comedy in Somalia.
Google it.
It takes brave people to make dangerous comedy.
It's a therapy. The little laughter takes away the stress.
Risking their lives just to make people laugh.
You said that. I didn't say that.
Comedians and actors and TV and filmmakers who make comedy in places where it doesn't belong.
Get people to laugh just a little about that which might be the most sacred, that we might get them to open up a little bit.
You discovered your comic sensibility as a tool for survival. You talk to the Western equivalent. It's like, oh, I did a little show for my grandparents, or I was in a talent show at school.
Spoiled.
Right.
We live our lives. We like doing our nails, too.
I still don't understand that shot. How do you get that shot? That was a woman in a burqa?
Who's a comedian.
Skating on a river.
Yes.
Veterans have a six-inch humor. That's how we deal with the job we got to do.
Girls know this, but you know,
this is a burn victim hooked. Comedian.
A veteran.
Is this the guy that ran for president?
No. He, but he was injured in Iraq.
Wow.
After his fourth tour of duty, a week into his fourth tour of duty.
Right.
And he has a landmine go off.
Well, I watch a lot of Netflix, and I was just an hour ago in a meeting with a piece of talent. We were talking about what works, in our opinion, on Netflix and not. And I said comedy is difficult, unscripted is difficult for them, but this is something I would watch. This has everything that I want to watch in it, right?
Yeah.
I don't know. For some reason, late night doesn't work. Take us through the format of it when you pitched it. Like, you know, it's you in a docuseries with a camera crew. How many guys do you have traveling
Such
with
a small crew, one camera.
You're like the Anthony Bourdain of comedy, right? And you're going into these countries.
Yes.
Right?
And it's I have a one camera, one sound guy, and two producers. And that's it, myself.
And what countries?
We started in Turkey. We went through Jordan.
Traditionally funny places.
Right, exactly. Well, that's what I was looking for. And all my life, I've been looking for comedy in places where it's not really supposed to be funny, even Seinfeld.
Right.
So we went through the Middle East, went from Turkey to Jordan to Palestine to Israel to Saudi Arabia. Wow. And Saudi Arabia was fascinating. And that's where I met Amy Rocco, the woman in the veil. She has about a million and a half followers on Instagram. She is a social media phenomenon.
She was doing what? Water skiing on a street?
She's water skiing on a street. She has all kinds of great bits. She does a bit about being jealous of Batman because his veil, he can eat because it's got a mouth thing. And with her, she has to lift the veil up.
So how do you put this together when you bring it into Netflix? Did you have all this stuff put together?
I know
if I go there, I'm not just on a fishing expedition. I've got X, Y, and Z to shoot.
Yes. One of the things, because I traveled so much with Sasha and doing commercials and all this kind of stuff, I was in a lot of oppressive regimes over the last few years. And every place I went, I'd meet comedians. People would know me or know Seinfeld. When we were in Jordan doing Bruno, this is the truth. There would be street sellers on the street of Amman selling bootleg DVDs.
Yes.
And there would always be the same four items amongst the street sellers. There would be Seinfeld bootleg DVD, Curb Your Enthusiasm bootleg DVD, Borat DVD bootleg, and Mein Kampf. It was always those four together. So it was very – and every place I met comedians. And so I started to Google the craziest places in the world and comedy. And I found that no matter how crazy – Somalia, for instance, where I went – there were always comedians there. And I thought, that's, I get to come home. I get accolades. I get rewards for my work, for creating havoc and mayhem. But these people have to stay. And I thought, I know there is, each of their stories are going to be fascinating. They're in war zones. They've been through all kinds of incredible torture and trauma. So I thought, I know there's a kind of a compelling juxtaposition between the seriousness and the tragedy and the comedy. And I knew that was a kind of a hook for a show.
You're listening to Larry Charles, whose new Netflix series is The Dangerous World of Comedy. We're going to hear a little more about it when we come back. 60 seconds. That's exactly how long this commercial lasts. You know what else you can do in about a minute? Get an offer with your car from TrueCar. That's right. In the amount of time it takes to floss your teeth, pet your dog, do a few sit-ups, just listen to my voice, you can get a true cash offer. Best of all, you can do it from your smartphone or at home. Just go to TrueCar, simply enter your license plate number, and watch how your car's details pop up. Answer a few questions, and you'll get an accurate true cash offer from local TrueCar certified dealer. It's that easy. After that, you can bring your car in, and they'll check it out with you together, the two of you. You can even hug if you want. You can ask questions, get the answers you need so there's no surprises, and simply leave your check or trade in your car for a new ride. So when you're ready to experience a new, better way to sell or trade in your car, check out TrueCar today.
You're listening to Spike's Car Radio.
And we're back! That's a Jerry. Did you ever get Jerry voice from writing his voice too much? I've got it. He's the last guy I really wrote a lot for, and I'm stuck in a Jerry voice.
I have never had that problem, actually.
No, you're right. He's the one
I'm stuck in Larry's voice. That's
why. You have a Larry voice?
Yeah.
You don't sound like him, though.
That's good. In my mind, I do.
I have a, I had Letterman voice. I had Louis C.K. voice for a while, even though I didn't.
Well,
write
I wrote
Louis,
with Bob Dylan, and I did that. I was Bob Dylan for a while.
Wow. Why were you writing for Bob Dylan?
We did a movie together, actually, called Masked and Anonymous back before all of that. And we wrote in a room for 2 years. And so after a while, I was talking like this.
Hey, Larry. What is that like? Is he a good writer?
He and Larry David are very similar people. They are savants.
Right.
They could only do what they do.
Yes.
And either you like it or you don't like it. If you don't like it, that's your problem. If they were sitting at a bus stop, homeless, they'd be doing the same thing. And that's what it was writing with Larry, and that's what it was writing with Bob. Very single-minded, very sure of their vision, very wise in what they were willing to share. Life-changing experiences. Working with Bob Dylan was absolutely a life-changing experience.
I remember him being at one of our Letterman anniversary dinners in some fancy restaurant there. And, you know, we got to meet him, and he says, hey, is this like that? It's just very low-key. It doesn't really say anything, right? And then the one of those flouncy models came over that Dave used to have on the show, and she walks up, and he's like, oh, hey, how you doing?
He's quoting 15th century poetry. Yeah.
No, he was just any nerdy guy like we were. Hey, oh, hi, it's really nice to meet you.
Yeah.
Oh, blah, blah, blah. And I went, wow, look at the power that girl has.
Yeah. He's a human.
Let's talk about Sacha Baron Cohen. Then we're going to get back to your series. I have more questions about that.
Of course.
You know, I don't know Sacha. I'm a huge fan of his. And I, you know, when I watch his comedy, you know, Who is America? I love his commitment, you know, in pre-production and post-production to not letting any secrets out. But I imagine myself not being part of such a production because I don't want to deal with that.
Yeah.
How, you know, what is he like to work with, you know, when he's walking in with just the germ of an idea? Like even Borat, you know, what does he say to you? Is this just a cone of silence between the two of you and we're slowly going to let production know about it as we book? How does that work? Let's stick with Borat.
All right. Well, Borat is a little different than the Showtime show because Borat, remember, he was doing in England already on his Ali G show. So he knew that character inside out. He had to wear the underwear of the character, the socks of the character, the jewelry of the character. He had to have the right stuff in his pockets.
Is he talking like that between takes?
There are no takes.
There's no take. Right.
There's
You're
one
just
take.
Going in and doing
and
it.
Also, he is talking like that from the time he comes out of the hotel room. He is Borat all day. I felt he should have been nominated for an Academy Award.
Yes.
Because he broke the mold of acting.
Yeah.
He was standing next to people 3 feet away, 1 foot away, as a fictional character, and they have to believe that he's real. That's truly acting. So when I would have arguments with him, I would argue with Borat.
Right.
So he was always Borat the entire day. It was exhausting, but he was Borat.
But aren't you having to explain movie production to Borat? Look, this is how a movie works, and I want to get it out. Does Borat understand that?
Well, a lot of what I would do is explain it to the people that we were about to target. I would say, look, he comes from another country. We're a freelance crew. I just met him.
Right.
I don't know very much about him. I know that he doesn't know anything about American culture. Please be patient. He's not comfortable with the language, and people would be really patient with
and
him.
And how, you know, I've done a little bit of hidden camera before with Jamie Kennedy and on my own show, and it's always really tense when you're pulling one over on somebody, right? Especially when cameras are rolling and you guys are in could be in a dangerous situation.
Yes.
Is that comfortable for you as the director, or did you get used to it?
No, the anxiety is overwhelming.
Yeah.
But I learned to ride it out and know that as much as my anxiety wants me to put a halt to it and just say, stop, please stop, I know that the scene is just getting started when my anxiety is rising.
Yes.
So I have to kind of ride that out in order to get the gold.
And
you know?
He's not going to let you call a cut.
Not at all. No.
Right?
There are no, like
there
I said,
no cuts.
When a scene fails, you have to leave the city. So it's a big deal when something doesn't work out.
Were there things that we didn't get to see in any of these movies that
were just too far? There's a six-hour cut of Borat, for instance. Okay? That's how much material there is. Now,
wait, where is the six-hour cut of Borat?
They're around.
I can rent that?
You can't. I wish you could. I wanted to put it out.
Who has that? I want to watch that this
I would
weekend.
Love to put it out. You would love it
Do
also.
Do you have it?
I have it like on a VHS tape or something.
Okay.
Yeah. All right. I'll hang out. You'd love it, though, also. I've often said that there's stuff – he wanted everything to be the funniest it could possibly be, and that's what's left in the movie.
Yeah.
But there was stuff that was outrageous and fascinating and crazy that maybe wasn't quite as funny, like him at a Civil War reenactment thinking that the war was really going on and trying to rape people who are acting as dead soldiers, and he's – pulling their pants. You know, we have stuff like that, long scenes like that.
Wow. Now, why didn't that make the movie? Look at Will. He's cracking up in there. That's hilarious.
Or, for instance.
Not that rape is hilarious. You misunderstand.
Yes,
but in this context, listener.
Yes. And this is soldier on soldier rape, which is kind of historically
accurate.
It's a little different.
He's raping corpses.
He's not raping live
people.
And I get
the feeling that went on for like 20 or 30 minutes.
So usually, because it took hours to set up, and then hours you couldn't just go in the middle of it.
Great.
Hey, we're tired, we're leaving. So you had to play it all out. So it was like a whole day sometimes. Some
I
want to
watch
scenes.
This. We got to release this.
Yes.
We've got to put it out. I wish I knew him.
I'm such a huge fan.
I even like when Who Is America was announced, just the way it was announced, the whole timing of it. Guess what I've been doing for the last year.
And the problem that he has.
Did you work on that?
No, I did not.
No.
And the problem that he has with that show. I mean, the show is great, but the problem that he has is with Borat and Bruno and Ali G, he had years to cultivate those characters.
Yes.
These characters he's having to formulate much more quickly.
Quickly, right.
And they're a little bit broader because of that. The details aren't quite as worked out as they would have been in his usual process.
Right.
Which is very painstaking.
Yeah. I also thought the environment, the political environment right now is a little trickier, right? Every comedy usually has a framework that you're trying to work within, and this one is so divided that you have to be careful now how you play those political jokes.
Yeah.
Because it touches notes that are unintentional. You'll hit a note here where you didn't mean to.
Yes.
And it looks wrong.
Yes.
Know?
Well, even the difference between Borat and Bruno kind of illustrated that for us, because Borat was an innocent character. People were willing to be patient and forgiving of him.
Right.
Bruno, because he was gay, openly gay, immediately hostility.
Right.
It was a much darker movie because the treatment of Bruno in that movie is much darker. A lot of violence, a lot of threats, a lot of jostling and hassling and hate. And so the movie took on a much darker hue because of that.
Yeah. I even noticed it with Michael Moore's last movie that, you know, there's just so much of this stuff out there right now that he used to be the guy we'd wait for his movie to come out. You'd watch it and go, wow, I just learned something. But there's so much out there right now. It's kind of hard to, get into that theater.
Every day careens us in a different direction also.
Yeah, right. And we're, you know, we just want to be entertained sometimes. It's funny. I was watching it, and I really liked that he was trying to make people laugh. It didn't quite matter what he was highlighting on either side, right?
Right.
That's what I appreciated about Who Is America. It was just, I'm going for the laughs.
Yes.
And there's so many people, you know, even when I say what I just said about Michael Moore, that will come out and accuse me of being some lefty comedian. And I'm always like, you know, I'm not. I'm a registered independent because on purpose, because I just like to, you know, reluctantly aim at whoever stepped in shit. That's how comedy works for me. It always has, you know, Weekend Update to David Letterman's monologues. It's right. All, and to my own monologues. It's just about who's stepping in shit. I don't care what side you're on. Who's going to get me the most laughs?
Well,
right?
Comedy has that aspect of journalism to it also, especially if you're working for Letterman or you're doing daily. I worked on the Arsenio Hall show.
Right.
So you're doing those daily jokes. You're kind of going through all the newspapers. You're reading whatever to try to get material. There's a desperation to that also. So you're grabbing anything you can. Any target is really available to you. So it's a lot of pressure, actually. But that's the thing. You have a kind of a journalistic approach to it. What? And then tomorrow it's gone.
Yeah. And you remember back then, you know, I was telling my wife about this. Back then there would be weeks when nothing would be happening.
Absolutely.
There'd be nothing, you know, the political cycle was 2 weeks. It was around elections. Then you never talked about it again unless Bill Clinton got a blowjob. And then, all right, here we go. We're going to mine that square inch down to China, right? And then there would be weeks where just nothing's happening, you know, and you have to manufacture a whole monologue. And that's where you'd get into the weird stuff. We're nowhere near that anymore.
It seemed like life was good. There would be periods where life was actually okay. You didn't have to worry about anything.
Yeah,
now,
right.
It's not like that anymore.
Now it's crazy and we're kind of burned out on all of it. All right, let's get back to the show.
Sure.
All right. So,
well, it's one of the reasons I did the show was I felt like the Trump era was kind of isolating us to a large degree.
You're right.
And I've spent a lot of time overseas and I've met a lot of these people. And I thought, this is a world that we don't know anything about. And we would really be cool with this world if we got to know it better, because we'd see how much these people are like us.
You're absolutely right. Because I, you know, when I was watching your stuff, I was going, God, in my first impression of these countries is they are bombed out husks of,
they
you
are.
Know, with people just barely surviving. But then as you watch it, you go, no, there's a culture there that's thriving, whatever condition the country's in, and they're having a life despite what's going on with their regime, kind of like us. You know?
Yes.
Maybe they're embarrassed like we are, but we're doing our thing, right?
Yes, very, very true.
Right?
Very true. And you know, it reminds me, my agenda going in was what we were just talking about, this journalistic quality. I thought I would go in and meet satirists in all these countries who had critiques of the government and their comedy was really criticizing the government. And there is a lot of that going on, obviously. But there was just as much comedy in these war-torn, strife-torn countries, violence-ridden countries, that was about healing and about lightening the load for a minute and healing people's anxiety and trauma for a moment. And I was really struck and really moved by that aspect of comedy and that power of comedy to be able to play that role.
Are there places where the comedians are in danger? Did you run into that?
Absolutely. I mean, virtually every country. I met a guy in Saudi Arabia named Fahad Al-Butari. He is known as the Seinfeld of Saudi Arabia. He looks a little bit like him. He does kind of
I'll do a show with him right now.
He's one of the first stand-ups in Saudi Arabia.
Wow.
And he's one of the first to talk about observational type of stuff. He looks like Seinfeld. And he is now in jail.
Oh.
Okay. And his wife also, who was one of the driving activists there, female driving activists, she is also in jail. So that's real. In Somalia, I met a comedian.
Was he arrested like Lenny Bruce? Like he was on stage and he just
in Saudi Arabia,
too far,
Saudi Arabia, you're just gone.
You just disappeared.
Nobody knows where he is, what happened to him. And it's, you know, it's not the system that we have here.
Right.
It's a Khashoggi system. You know, it's the Khashoggi system. Mm-hmm. In Somalia, which is the most dangerous place I went to by far.
Why is that dangerous? Besides the extreme poverty and the pirates and just
right. There's no government.
No force,
there's no government. There's no money.
Right.
There's no currency.
Yeah.
Literally. There are many, many factions, all heavily armed. You don't know whose side who's on.
Right.
The violence is so commonplace. Everybody is armed. And I met a comedian who was
How did you do that?
How did I meet a comedian?
Because back in the day, I traveled through Cambodia where there was no infrastructure. I didn't meet any comedians.
Right.
No one spoke the language. How did you meet?
It was very, very tough to connect. First of all, it was very tough to get to Somalia
in
the first place. We were in Nigeria. You can't just fly like you can from LA to New York, from the west coast of Africa to the east coast. No. You have to leave the continent. So we would have to fly to Turkey and then catch a plane to like Ghana.
Okay.
And then take like a
Then you land.
Yeah, and then you land
in
Somalia.
Say, bring me your comedians.
Right, exactly.
And what do they say?
They're all in one place, essentially, because there's only one place that's safe. There is a radio station there, which is where they do most of their work. They have a little TV show. They have some radio stuff. They do social media kind of stuff.
Wow.
There's not a lot of live stand-up in Mogadishu, as you can well imagine. but one of the comedians was assassinated there also.
Jesus.
I mean, actually just assassinated.
Right.
And that is not – the guy that I met in Iraq, Ahmad Al-Bashir, who hosts The Daily Show of Iraq.
Right.
He's been tortured, jailed. He has been – had his family wiped out. You know, this is real consequences
wow.
to the stuff that they do.
Mm-hmm.
So I met a lot of people like that. Yeah, almost all of them are affected by their circumstances and yet continue on.
And what is it that triggers the government against the John Stewart of Iraq when he's out there? He just makes one – it's one joke too far that the government gets upset
exactly.
about?
Exactly. And he's an equal opportunity offender as the best comedians are.
Right.
He makes fun of ISIS too and they're not happy with him either.
Oh, Jesus.
But the Iraqi government, which is very corrupt – and much more corrupt
yeah.
than we ever really hear about.
Mm-hmm.
And the Kurds, there's so many different factions in all these war-torn countries that we only get the most simplistic details about them. But in truth, it's a very complicated picture. And his job, he feels, is to clarify it, make fun of it, and give the audience hope as well, which is another aspect of this that you don't see as much like an American comedy.
Well, is he going to be safe when this comes out? I mean,
he can't even do the show in Iraq anymore.
Right.
He has to do the show in a different country.
Is there Netflix in Iraq? Is there Iraqi Netflix?
I don't know.
Somalia.
I know they love the show.
Netflix.
I profiled a few other Iraqi comedians as
Boy,
well.
Boy, this sounds like a great show.
It's fun, man. It's really cool.
And how many episodes did you make?
Four.
Four?
Yeah.
Oh, we got
to
make more of these.
I would love to.
Because there are plenty of places, right?
Yes.
What a great idea.
Yeah.
Wow, this is really good for them. Because, you know, there's been such a glut of stand-up comedy specials on Netflix.
Right.
You know, Jerry and I were just talking about it. You know, you really have to do something different. This really sounds like it.
Please say hello to Jerry. I haven't talked to him in a long time.
Hello, Jerry.
Tell him that I love him. I, you know, I respect
You're
him.
Not a Jerry guy.
I'm not
He's
a Jerry
not
guy.
Interested in Larry Charles.
That I know. I understand that.
He's out here
that.
All the time. Come driving with us. Are you a car guy? Do you like cars?
I have a Maserati right now.
You
I
do? Mean,
he, well, here's a story with me and Jerry and cars.
Okay.
I used to have a Saab. Okay.
Oh, wait a minute.
Yes.
I know this story. Laurel Canyon?
Yes.
You're the racer?
Yes.
Oh, my God. Tell the story. I know this story.
At the end of every show, when we finished taping, we would go to Jerry's Deli to eat, where Andy Kaufman was sometimes, by the way, bussing tables.
Mm-hmm.
And when the meal was over, he would get in his Porsche, and I would get in the Saab. We both lived in West Hollywood, and we would try to race across Laurel Canyon. He would give me a head start.
Yes.
He let me go all the way from Ventura to Mulholland.
Oh, my God.
Okay? And I would be going, and I would be getting to Mulholland, and be going, wow, I'm going to do it this time. I'm going to beat him. And I would see the lights coming behind me of the Porsche. And just as I got to Mulholland, he would pass me.
Was this the black car, the black 88 911?
It might have been. I'm not sure. He had a couple of different
and
ones he was playing with at that
he
time.
He used to tell me about this, that he and Larry Charles used to race. That's back when Jerry did wacky stuff like that.
Yeah.
I lived on Franklin when I started writing for the show. Whenever I'd bump into him, he'd be coming from Doheny. We'd look next to each other and we would race. And one time he drove so recklessly. He had this turquoise 993 turbo, you know, or maybe it was, I don't even know what it was, but he went so fast around a blind corner and the show was so big at that time.
Yeah.
That I just stopped. I said, I'm not doing this anymore because if you get killed or kill somebody and I'm the guy, you know, I can't be the end of Seinfeld.
I wish I had that thought. That would have probably been a good thought for me to have. I never, crossed
it wasn't
my mind.
That show.
Yeah, yeah.
When, by the time I got to the show, there were helicopters over the set. It really was a big deal and it really would have mattered. Now, that's really funny. You were the original Seinfeld racer.
Yes, I was.
And now you've got the Maserati. What is it, a quadruport?
No, I have a Ghibli.
The Ghibli.
Yes.
Well, it doesn't seem like you. I would put
I know.
You in
it's,
old
it's
kind
not.
Of ZZ Top kind of American
a Lincoln,
muscle cars.
I had a Lincoln Town Car, and then I had a Cadillac Fleetwood before that.
Wow.
But the Fleetwood, it's just too much work.
Wow.
And the Town Car also, was just too much work after a while. So,
yeah.
But this is too much work also.
Directing's
actually,
not
more,
too much work.
More work, you know.
Yeah.
Well, so I don't know what's going to come next.
When you're doing Curb... that seems like a hard show to do because isn't Larry just fleshing out the scenes on a board and then, you know, how much is that? I've never really, asked him or anybody on that show, how much is scripted out beforehand?
Well, it's a like a 10 or 11 page outline.
Right.
And so you have pretty detailed paragraphs explaining what needs to happen in the show. And occasionally within those paragraphs, we'll even put in specific lines that need to be said.
Right.
So there is a kind of a real guide for the scene. Then you have the good luck of casting properly, and then you put Larry and the right people together in that scene with that goal.
Right.
And generally speaking, you're going to get there. It might take a couple of iterations, but you will eventually get there. Everybody's got the right instinct and moving in the right direction.
Yeah.
So it works out. Now, when it doesn't work out, which is occasionally it does not work out, then you really are stuck because it's hard to pull funny out of that situation.
Right.
And then usually it's because – and this happened in Seinfeld too. The scene is wrong somehow. Something about the scene is wrong. The dynamic of that scene, the chemistry, the balance
of that
scene.
Right, but you have
scene.
An audience there. It's different.
Exactly,
and
yeah.
here you don't,
yeah.
right?
Yeah, we used to rewrite the scenes in front of the audience sometimes too.
Right, on Seinfeld.
Yeah,
but on Curb,
yeah, sure.
there's nothing there, so it's extra hard. Your
on
search
Curb,
is...
sometimes we went back. What was brilliant about Larry and what he learned from Seinfeld was he built in a reshoot schedule.
Right.
So when we go into editing and things didn't work, we could go out and reshoot it.
Oh,
we always
could
reshoot,
good.
Yeah. Very important.
It's really
part
amazing
of
the way he does that, too. He's yeah. got a show that's uncancelable and just he does it when he wants to do it.
And for as long as he wants.
His for schedule, as long as he wants, right.
I was doing Entourage and that at the same time, Entourage and Curb for a season at the same time.
Right.
And we had to do like 4 days on Entourage to do an episode where Larry always had 8 days. You know, so the difference in his schedule was we could really look for stuff and let things sort of ferment naturally.
Were you – I remember meeting about Entourage early on. Were you there at the very beginning of that?
Yeah.
remember going into CAA and meeting there and not really going, wait, what? You're
maybe
doing
what? I came – once they made the pilot,
right.
They weren't happy with the pilot
I
and
see.
They brought me in. And
right.
that's when I started working on that show.
Wow. That's a great show. What a resume you have, Larry Charles.
Weird. Very eclectic.
You're very accomplished.
But it's all led to this show.
It's all led to here, Spike's Comedy and Car Radio. You got it, Will. When you do the description for this podcast, you've got to put that in. This is the guy who used to street race, illegal street race, Jerry Seinfeld, up Laurel Canyon. And thankfully, you're all still alive. Well, thank you for coming in and chatting with us.
My pleasure.
Been a great deal of fun. Again, the show is called Larry Charles' Dangerous World of Comedy. It's up on Netflix right now, and it's Spike endorsed. I'm going to watch every episode, and I want them to make more of them. I'll make sure to mention that next time in there.
Me too.
Thanks for coming in, Larry, and I will,
pleasure.
Of course, tell Jerry that you want to hang out. Come driving with us. I always say to people I like on the show, come driving with us. We'll call you up, but then they never come.
I don't want to sit in the back seat. That's why.
Well, no, you take
a
car.
I have to call shotgun.
You take a car. We all have cars laying around.
You just take
somebody's car. You would understand this. You're a dude. We just take a drive, and we land at a place, and we have coffee, and we talk about cars, comedy, and wives.
I do that on my own. I do that by myself now.
But again, you're a Larry guy, so it may not work for you.
Well,
Jerry
you know,
guys, it works for. Larry guys, I'm not so sure.
You know Larry had the Porsche. You know that whole story that Jerry got
on
the
do.
Porsche. He didn't want it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
No, I know. He had, and he drove the Prius for the longest time.
Yes.
I gave him shit about it. Maybe that's why he's not happy.
I went with them. Jerry took Larry initially when the show first got picked up to Fontana. We went to Fontana. To buy Larry a Lexus.
Yeah.
And I remember taking that trip. It was like the three of us going to you know, buy a Lexus.
That's
that was
hilarious.
Fun. Yeah.
And how did that how did that look? What did Larry need hand-holding for? The deal part or the car-picking part?
Well, you know, Jerry relishes all those encounters.
Yeah, of
and
course.
Larry can't stand them. So
right.
he would not have done it if Jerry hadn't taken him by the hand and done it.
And he got him that Lexus.
Yes.
And the Porsche was the famous one-day Porsche,
one
right?
One day he couldn't
I'm getting
take
rid
it.
Of it. I
yeah,
couldn't stand
couldn't
it. And what
it.
Didn't he like about it?
He didn't like to see himself in it.
But then when I saw him in the turns out in the Palisades in a little black Prius, and I saw him, had dinner with him shortly after, I said, you know, it doesn't look right, Larry. It just doesn't, you know, all that you've accomplished and all the money you have, and that's it? The black Prius? It's got to be. And then, you know, they invent the Tesla, and now he's probably
he
got
likes
one
to
of those.
Be able to shift, though. Like, I was in front of him one time going into Radford, and he made an illegal left turn using the Lexus, and a cop pulled him over, and suddenly I watched him. He became – it was a great acting experience. He became a little old man, and, like, he just told him – he didn't know what was going
I'm
on.
Sorry, I'm lost.
And the guy let him go.
Really?
You know? So he wants – when you're in a Porsche, you can't really fake it like that.
No, you're right. You can't, though I've gotten away with it. I've seen seen Cherry get pulled over a bunch of times, and they just let him go. Nice to meet you, Mr. Seinfeld.
Right,
Mr. Ferriston, come over here for a minute. And then I get the ticket.
Yeah.
Let me just ask you one more question.
Yes,
I know I already said goodbye. One more question about Curb and Larry.
Of course.
Where is your barometer on, you know, I know people will come up to Larry and go, oh, and they're well-meaning, but they're, Larry, you're such an asshole. I model my whole life after you. You're such an asshole. I love you, right? Which is kind of a rude thing to say to Larry. The character of Larry on Curb, in my opinion, is pretty exaggerated, right?
It's an aspect that Larry can channel.
Right.
You know,
right.
He sees those situations coming at him all the time, but he doesn't react the way he does on Curb. He writes it down in the notebook.
That's one of the tips he gave me when I was learning how to write that show. He's like, what did you want to say? What did you want to do?
Exactly.
Right.
Exactly. And that's pretty much what he does. Now, he's in a position because he's such an icon now that he can actually behave like that in real life as well. But initially, it was about really getting to that point and then writing down the idea of what would happen. Yeah.
Do you know how much money we could all make if we brought that show back right now? That's billions.
Yes.
Right? I just read Kelsey Grammer's coming back with his show, whatever it was, that would beat us in the Emmys every year.
Until we stop going, by the way.
Try to remember the name of that show. Try to remember an episode of that show, my friends.
Exactly.
And they're coming back with that. Can you imagine if we walked into NBC right now with Larry and Jerry and just said, we just want to do six more? What would happen to all of us? How big that would be? But it's never going to happen, folks.
It's never going to happen, exactly.
This is all you get, a little fond
John,
recollection
remember,
time.
John and George are dead.
What?
John and George are dead.
That's right. They're dead.
There can't be no Beatles. Oh, no Beatles reunions.
There's got to be something. You know, next year is the 30th anniversary of the show. They have all of these big plans in New York.
No one's gotten in touch with me about anything, by the way.
I've been talking to the folks at Sony and hearing about it, at least, tangentially, and, you know, offering my help in any way. I heard there was going to be an apartment maybe set up and some other stuff. I've always advocated, and you've probably had this experience, and definitely as a director, you know what I'm talking about. When you go to the Hollywood Bowl and you watch E.T., you watch one of these old movies with your family, and you have this collective, we all love this thing, and everybody applauds for every big line, or they have them on the Forest Lawn Cemetery sometimes.
Right.
Immediately, I think of Seinfeld, and, you know, at two or three places in the summertime, we get Hollywood Bowl, we have some of us, the actors come up, we run three episodes, we have the guy who did the funny sound, I'm spacing his name right now.
Jonathan
Wolf, go bam, 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 you know, like that's our symphony. And we have a live event for the fans of this show, you know, not making money, but so we can all kind of hang out together.
That is a better idea than a reboot. That is a fantastic
idea. It's a good
idea,
right?
Because I will tell you, I have been involved over the last few years in, first of all, going to see friends and families or screenings of Borat and hearing the audience laugh live. But I've also done a couple of these events, and I'm sure you have too, where we've shown Curb live or Seinfeld's live and heard the roaring laughter.
Right.
Greater than any laughter you get from most movie comedies. And yes, I think it's a fantastic idea to bring people together rather than sitting in your house and watching it, to see it as a mass audience responding. Yeah. I think it would be
right. And you
gigantic.
Bring the cast up, you bring some of the writers. I mean,
absolutely. That's
E.T.,
a great idea.
They had a video of John Williams in his living room introducing it, and we were all swooning over the guy.
And you could do it for charity. It doesn't have to be for money, but it would be a tremendous event.
It'd give us a moment to get together with the fans.
Great
anyway,
idea.
There
That's
you
a great
go.
Idea. I love it.
Wow. I feel so good that Larry Charles just blessed my idea.
I think it's great.
All right. We're going to do it. We're going to figure it out.
Okay,
I happen to know the guy running Sony, and I'm going to make him do it, and then I'm going to make Jerry, and I'm going to make Larry do it. This has been Larry Charles and Spike Ferriston. So long until next week on Spike's Car Radio.
Thanks for listening to Spike's Car Radio. Download new episodes every Wednesday on the Podcast One app or subscribe now at Apple Podcasts or PodcastOne.com.
It's time to get your fitness on with the nation's premier personal trainer and wellness coach, Ben Greenfield, each week on Ben Greenfield Fitness here on Podcast One.
But I want to show you some of the tips that I use to put on muscle quickly when I was bodybuilding and do it completely naturally.
Need more fitness advice? Join Ben this week as he meets up with podcast legend Adam Carolla on The Adam Carolla Show. Download Ben Greenfield Fitness every Wednesday and don't miss Ben on The Adam Carolla Show on Podcast One or wherever you get your favorite podcasts.
Hope that was helpful. I'll catch you next time.